Hello and welcome to this month's episode of MIA Podcast. I say this every month, but this month we have an extra special guest. You may figure it out from the names, but I've got my dad on. And the reason for this is that my dad has been the inspiration behind MIA Podcast. My dad was back, was in manufacturing back in the glory days of the 60s. The whole point of this podcast is that we explore this topic of will Australia ever return to the glory days of the 60s? And what better way to hear about what it was like than to have it from the horse's mouth and have someone who was there at the time. So welcome, Dad.
Thank you, John, and thank you very much for inviting me to speak. I think it's great that you're taking this special interest in manufacturing and encouraging people to grow it, and I think that's really great. So it's really nice to be able to help.
Absolute pleasure. And I think we can all agree, all of us watching, listening, whatever it might be, that Australia has been the one of the major backbones of the Australian economy. If you look back at the introductory video as to what the podcast is all about, it's to raise awareness in the Australian community of what's happening in manufacturing right now. There's a lot going on, especially in the last 2 years since COVID's hit. There's some really big advantages that Australia can take advantage of in the world market. And, you know, this is what this podcast is all about, to look at what movements are driving manufacturing, where manufacturing is what right now, who's supporting manufacturing, what problems there are, how can we solve them? And as I said in the introduction, you know, will Australia return to the glory days of the 60s? So I think we worked out, Dad, that you started working in manufacturing in 1958 and retired in 2006. So we're looking at about just under 50 years, so 48 years. And so you've obviously seen a lot change over the years, and you know, I think when Australia went from that huge manufacturing went from a huge component of GDP down to a much smaller component, and you know, obviously a little bit of the dive that we're experiencing today. So look, what I wanted to broadly ask was what was it like for you, because you're a junior accountant. Was that the correct title when you first started?
Well, I was a trainee accountant, which meant you were basically the office boy when you first started, but it was a great way to learn all the ropes.
Paper, pen, and it would have been pencil and pen, wouldn't it?
Yeah, very. Well, I mean, I just worked my way up to accountant, then chief accountant, and then I think we got called chief financial officer and whatever terms are around at the time, but it was very interesting. I enjoyed it, and I like that aspect of accounting where you're out in the factory seeing how things are made and discussing and asking questions about it. And it was a very busy time, as you could imagine, because Australia was very much into manufacturing. That combined with the fact that most of the accounting systems were semi-manual, particularly stock control and that sort of thing, compared to today, it was a very interesting time.
Yeah, and you started in Fivedoc in Sydney.
That's right.
Yeah, and do you want to give a little bit of an insight into, because, I mean, these days, Fivedoc, Drummoyne, they're all like multi-million dollar houses. No one would ever think it was sort of an industrial, well, part of it was industrial. Do you want to give a little bit of an insight into what Fivedoc was like back in those days?
Yeah, well, Crompton Parkinson, that was a company I worked for, which became part of the Hawker Siddeley Group, the aircraft group, but we didn't do anything to do with aircraft manufacture. We're electric motors, switch gear, control gear, lighting, and high voltage switch gear stuff. And the Fivedoc property, actually, when I started, was a very busy place, a big property. We used to make high voltage substation transformers there as well as electric motors. And we also had a factory at Campbelltown that manufactured switchgear and high voltage circuit breakers, and also small electric motors. Small electric motors were those under 1 horsepower, whereas Five Dot produced those sort of from 1 horsepower up to, I think it was about 200 horsepower at least. I don't know if it went to 400, but certainly 200 horsepower, which was a very big electric motor. And that was used to drive steel mills and sugar mills up in Queensland. That was another big customer. So,
and if you look carefully at some of the old, like quite old equipment, you know, sometimes in like an old factory or something like that, occasionally you still see the old Compton Parkinson logo on the motors.
Yeah, there's still quite a few around. And I don't know if there's many of the big power station transformers still in use, but as was with Australian manufacturing at the time, things were manufactured to last. There was no such thing as building obsolescence into anything. It was there to work for a long time.
Yeah, high quality. And
yeah, I mean, I was told stories that the transformers we manufactured up at Maitland, and they had a dreadful flood at Maitland in 1953, I think it was. And from what I believe, when the flood went down, the engineers went up, just brushed off the insulators on the transformer, cleaned them up, pressed the circuit breaker on, and they worked perfectly because they were manufactured by tradesmen and boilermakers using big quarter-inch steel plate, not like the current ones, which are very thin. Yeah. And things were made to last.
Yeah, I suppose that's that whole thing of, I guess they would have been more to purchase, but the long-term benefit would far outweigh the initial purchase price.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we were selling to the electricity authority that looked after all of New South Wales at the time, and they bought them to last.
Yeah.
In fact, we used to do impulse testing on them, which was at Five Dock. It was doing make-believe lightning strikes by part of the factory that had some big capacitors, a bit like something out of Star Wars, really. And we got a big government grant for that. That's how the government used to support us. That was the development grant for manufacturing grant. And that was a big operation, testing those so that... I think it was the New South Wales Electricity Commission that used to buy them all.
Oh, yes.
And
that's a good customer to have.
Yeah.
So, look, let's jump into a slightly different... Actually, just before I do, I think you mentioned there was, like, some brick pits and all sorts of, like, we would say crazy stuff out of Five Dock, because Five Dock probably was almost... You go a bit further west and there was probably almost paddocks back in those days.
So we had
was there brick pits or?
Yeah, we had a big quarry.
Quarry, that's the one. Yeah.
And that was at the back. And I think all the mistakes used to just roll down the hill down into the quarry. But eventually we had a quarry there, and there was another one opposite. And the road at the back was actually just stones. It wasn't even sealed back in 1958. Eventually the quarry got filled for parking because the company was getting bigger, and they sold all the land on the other side to Des Moines Council for housing.
Well, there you go. If you're living in Des Moines, you might be living on one of the old factories, factory land at least, anyway.
Yeah, you could be, yeah. And of course, your mum, my wife, she only lived two streets away. And there's a lot of dumping going on in that land opposite. And she found an old sofa there and found some money in it.
Yeah, that's true.
Brother came around the next day and ripped the whole thing apart just to make sure there was no money left.
Yes. So, look, from your insights, why would you say that Australian manufacturing was so successful back in those days?
It was the...
Why would you say Australian manufacturing was so successful back in the days of the 60s?
Well, I don't. There certainly weren't goods coming in from other countries like we've got now, and I think the rest of the world was still trying to come to grips with shortages created after the war and things like that. And I know that even with the big electric motors, you never had anything available ex stock. They were always manufactured to order, and I think sometimes you had to wait 1 or 2 months to get the motor, because there was just huge demand, and I think all manufacturers were sort of just flat chat trying to fulfill the orders and that sort of thing. And we didn't have goods coming in like we do now from all around the world. I think we had duties in place, which were eventually lifted when the government, both Labor and Liberal governments, sort of supported the level playing field. And all the duties were taken away, and I think that sort of created a few problems. But I mean, I saw my boss showed me a telegram that came in 1939, and this is the sort of thing we could be facing today if we're not careful, where our parent company now was faced with the war in the UK and said, we can't supply any more components. You know, please try and see us. Get them locally, which the engineers had to try and do back in 1939, and that's how the factory then got bigger and bigger, and I think it just kept growing after that and into the 50s and 60s, and it wasn't until the 70s that this level playing field started to bite in, and despite lots of submissions to the Industries Assistance Commission on behalf of all the manufacturers, there was us and Pope and AEI and all the well-known industries, it just didn't sort of go anywhere. The gates were open and we had to compete, and it was, I just think, Australian-made products too well to last. And a lot of the other product coming in, of course, had a limited shelf life, a limited life, really.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point, actually, because you know, that is starting to creep in these days, especially with supply chain shortages due to COVID and you know, logistical challenges, price of transport. It's had people rethink about at least producing locally. It's going to be interesting to see. There is a social layer that's coming into the world of manufacturing, and this whole concept of responsible manufacturing. And that is exactly what you mentioned. It's a social push to move away from buy a TV and it lasts for 2 years and throw it away, versus let's make something that lasts a lot, lot longer. It's high quality. We're probably gonna, the cost is probably gonna be a little bit more, but it's gonna last you a lot more as well. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, just in terms of that whole concept of costing more. You know, then we've got layers of put something on a payment plan, you know, like Afterpay, all those sort of companies as well, or some sort of financing. And whether that's going to help to accelerate manufacturing and manufacturing in Australia. So it's that's going to be very interesting. And I would dare to say, like back in the 50s and 60s, I suspect labor costs were not as big a player in the world market, but definitely not back then, before you had countries like, you know, I suppose the biggest one that we all know of is China, where their costs of production were massively a massively smaller percentage to what we could compete with, especially in the 80s and 90s. But I think that, you know, China's costs are rising. Well, you know, shipping costs are rising. There's a lot of costs that are rising that are now just throwing everything into a bit of turmoil and hopefully, you know, a bit of sanity at the other end. But one other point I wanted to touch on is that whole thing of Australia's always been known for quality. And if you look at some of the bigger products in the market, there is definitely that push for let's go for quality over price, and you know, push for that as well. So
yeah. Well, I think quality, I mean, I brought this up just to show you, and it's just that's my power drill.
Look at that.
And that was given to me by my dear Marjorie when we got married in 1970. So that's 52 years old. I'm still using it. Now, I'm not going around building houses, but it's still running okay. It's been serviced once, just to get the lead fixed up and that sort of thing. So basically, let's keep going. And that was made by a company called Lightburn. Now, probably not many people would know who Lightburn is today, but Harold Lightburn was a brilliant Australian engineer, and he used to manufacture cement mixers, which people may not know these days, but just about every building site in Sydney would have had a Lightburn cement mixer on it, well made. The story goes that you could drop it off the second story, go down, pick it up, put it back, plug it in, and it'd work. And Harold also developed an Australian car called the Zeta, which I don't know whether many people know that, but there was another manufacturer of Australian cars. But he was typical of Australian manufacturers, you know, trying their best to develop the product range. And but once again, it came back to quality. Everybody made things that were well made.
Yeah, I love that. And I think this is where we, Australian manufacturing, with a bit of some sort of direction and help, or further direction and help, we can push that line even harder. So if you're listening, have a chat with your marketing department, agency, whoever it is that you're working with, and that's definitely an angle that we can go with from that export perspective. Now, do you want to give a bit of an insight? We've had a bit of a chat about this, but that whole concept of exporting, like these days, I think who we're talking to, exporting seems to be relatively straightforward. I won't say it's easy, but it's way more straightforward. There's a lot of handholding. And there's a lot of initiatives to grow the Australian export market. What was it like back in your day?
Well, some were very difficult, and I got involved in getting things cleared. Some countries required tremendous documentation, and then other countries were okay. We used to sell a lot of product to Malaysia, Singapore, and obviously New Zealand, because we had reciprocal trade there. But there were difficulties with some countries, and a lot of documentation to get right in the first place. But the export market was quite strong, and the government had an export market development grant. So all we did, certain types of expenditure could be, you got a grant on them, and the guy would come out and go through our books and see what we'd spent, and so we're trying to grow the export market, which was very good at the time, but I don't think we'd export it very much now into Malaysia, Singapore, or some of those countries, but it was quite strong in those days, and the government was definitely supportive.
I mean, our economy absolutely reflected that. It was very strong economy back then, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that came in mainly, I think, when the UK went into the common market and they stopped buying product, mainly dairy and rural products from New Zealand and Australia, and they had to try and build up Australian manufacturing to offset the loss of export earnings.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
and that worked very well.
Now, I remember I'm not sure if you have it in front of you, but you did show me there was a piece of paper that you had, which was, I think, an application for a grant or something along those lines. There was some sort of paperwork you showed me recently, which was to do with exporting and just all the manual line items that had to go in there. And, you know, it was a very resource intensive part of business to get into exporting.
It was very time consuming and very frustrating sometimes, because I think particularly US companies, or like I think we're dealing with the Philippines, And you can't have one thing wrong. You know, it's got to be spot on all the way through. But I think after a while we started using specialized agents to do it, and I think that helped a bit, who've got the knowledge and the skills and that sort of thing.
But, yeah, I think from typically that's, I mean, that's what people seem to be doing these days as well. So there's a lot of agencies out there that do to help with that as well. And one of the things that we're seeing as well is with the whole generation four of manufacturing is that we're getting lots of different systems to talk to each other. As an example, we might have you might have an agency who deals with exporting, and then we're connecting, say, a manufacturer's supply chain digitally to their actual to their supply chain, and then to their client market as well. So whether it be through the logistics chain, the supply chain, the delivery chain, you know, that all components of the chain to essentially eliminate a lot of the resources required to export, and also just to make exporting smarter as well. So that whole thing of, you know, if your supply chain is not able to supply, you either switch to a different supplier, which then has an import impact on your ability to deliver who you're delivering to, and it just dramatically speeds up that process. So there's a lot of intelligent layers that are coming through in the past couple of years, and will do so in the future as well. So it'd be exciting to see where that heads.
It will be. Yeah. It's very encouraging to see the people who are now sort of saying Australia must manufacture a lot more and grow. And you see things that people are setting up factories, and that's good to see. I mean, it's the manufacturing base back in the 70s was enormous. I mean, we had company, we made everything, and we weren't self-sufficient, but we're very close to it.
Yeah.
And if we had something happen, at least we were able to supply all the products and that sort of thing, which today would be very difficult because we're so reliant on other countries.
Yeah, 100%. And
from what I can understand, I think BlueScope Steel's the only company now producing steel in Australia, and I believe a lot of people are finding it very hard to get product at very short notice.
Yes.
Back in our days, I mean, we had huge steel works at Newcastle and Whyalla, and Australian Iron and Steel at Cringilla, and
there's a few people we're speaking to who are saying that the actual processing raw materials is starting to creep back into Australia, which is great.
That's good.
But it is a very important point of that self-sufficiency. I guess we went through, especially through the 80s and 90s, where it was just like, let's just buy lots of stuff. We don't care where it's come from as long as it's cheap. We come out of the end of the Cold War, and I guess the risk of the perceived risk of countries being at war with each other was dramatically reduced. At the end of the day, Australia is an island, and if anything happens in our region, we are pretty cut off. And it's a strong point of an argument that part of a country needs to be able to look after itself, at least for the minimum goods anyway. And having, manufacturing is the thing that's going to help that. So,
I totally agree with you. I think that's so important. I mean, I think most sort of grey-haired people like myself now have been saying for probably about 20 years Australia needs to get its manufacturing back for exactly the reasons you said, because we are isolated and it's getting more difficult, I think. And back in the 70s, we never worried about things not being able to produce it. We felt we were pretty well self-sufficient, and that was a good thing.
Yeah, and something else, one of our other guests, I think it was Brian Lim, who was the space manufacturer, was saying that even from a logistics side, that there's a risk of piracy as well, as in pirates, you know, attacking ships that are
sending
goods around the world. So from a logistical point of view, being an island is, you know, we could potentially be a target of definitely, there's definitely a level of risk. So I wanted to talk about something more the labor side now, which is apprenticeships. So back in your day, I remember you saying that apprenticeships were just, they were definitely just commonplace percentage of the workforce in pretty much most companies, but definitely in manufacturing. You had boilermakers, you had electricians, you know, everything going through a business like yourself, where there was a skilling up of people coming out of school, whatever it might be, but definitely that knowledge handover, which I think has been lost recently. And I hope we catch it in time so that we don't have a whole generation of information lost. I think the apprenticeships are starting to start up again. But what were apprenticeships like back in your day?
Well, the 1970s, I suppose. Crompton Parkinson had a factory at Campbelltown and one at Five Dock. And at one time we had 42 apprentices, and we had a retired personnel officer, or HRI, they'd call him today, I suppose, just to look after them, because there was that much work doing the indentures and moving them around to get their training. And they were, of course, in electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, tool making, which is probably, tool making's probably dropped off a bit now because a lot of it's done electronically. And plus just some ordinary trades where maintaining the buildings and painting and all that sort of stuff. And of course, these young men, after they had done their apprenticeship, they may go on then to get a job out in private enterprise doing painting and plumbing and that sort of thing. But it gave them the insights to fitting and turning and that sort of thing. And they also had a cadet engineering scheme where we used to put on young men to, we'd pay the university fees and allow them to go full time. And all they had to do was come in over the university break and do a bit of work and show us what they're doing and that. And then when they left or graduated, they were expected to spend a little bit of time helping in the company and taking on a job there for a while. And that worked very well. And I actually have keep touch with a couple of the guys, and they've all retired now, of course, but it was quite a big thing, the cadet engineer scheme.
And how do you think it, I mean, obviously it addressed this whole issue that we are facing at the moment where, like you said, a fitter and turner or whatever it might be, there's a gap in knowledge unless they're lucky enough to be working with someone who has been around for a while. I feel like we've had this drop off of knowledge. You've got the older generation, we've got a fairly new generation, just because there's some good government schemes coming through now, and we've obviously got to join the two together. But I dare say there's a lot of knowledge that's just completely disappeared. Like the boilermakers, I don't think there's many boilermakers left in Australia.
No, it's a very, very difficult to get a boilermaker, I believe.
Yeah, and this is a complete side subject, but, you know, my dad and I were both interested in trains. And just recently, one of Australia's most famous trains, 3801, was restored. And they were lucky to have some younger men and females come along as well and be part of the restoration of the steam engine to essentially get their hands dirty, learn some of the old skills like boiler making and, you know, all the engineering side of it. And you know, there's a lot of skill that go into building and maintaining a steam engine. And that was, from memory, that was up at Newcastle they did that.
That's right. And
you know, they were sort of lucky to have that knowledge handover, but I suspect there's probably a lot that's been lost. So somehow we've got to make up that gap.
There is a lot of knowledge. I mean, the apprentices work with the tradesmen. I think you're allowed to have so many apprentices to so many tradesmen. So, and these guys would pass their knowledge on and show their skills, and these young men learnt a lot of good things by just being there, working at the on the site and on the job and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
and a lot of that knowledge is now lost, of course, and but I guess we can get it back slowly. I mean, some of the things have changed. A lot more numerically controlled lathes now, and a lot more computer input on a lot of jobs like tool making. It's been very much computerized now, making tools, that sort of stuff.
Very much, very much so. I was watching a presentation the other day with, I think it was, was it AutoCAD, one of those companies anyway, that you know, that whole automation of do the building, the engineering side, and the simulation in a computer, and then push it out to a lathe and help it do its thing as well. Just on that note, I do remember I must have been in year, I think it was year 7 or 8, coming to the factory out at Campbelltown. It was back then you had, I think, 1 or 2 robots.
That's right.
Working on the line, and it was exciting for me to see a robot because I, you know, there weren't that many around back in those days. But that was sort of the introduction to automation to some level as well.
Yeah, that was good. They were mainly pick and place and that sort of thing, but they were working. And then I think you spent some time at the Reesby factory when Campbelltown came down to Reesby, and we took over Betts Motors. And I think you spent a bit of time on the line there, didn't you? And they had a CAD cam. And
yeah, I did, yes. That was good, yeah. It's got to spend a few months building electric motors in the factory. There's a lot of hand tooling, but still then, and a lot of hand construction, putting the motors together and, you know, putting them on the production line and whatnot. They were pretty heavy. They were like 20-25 kilos each, so they, you know, help me get fit. But one of the things I do remember from working there was a guy on one of the lathes, and I, you know, during the break, put our hearing protection off, and I was like, how long have you been here for? And he's like, oh, you know, 30, almost 40 years. He was someone who had been working there since World War II. Right. And I said, you know, what have you been doing in the factory? He's like, this is my job, 35, 40 years, just operating that lathe. Okay. So proud of his work too. that was quite interesting to see that. This level of, you know, he loved his work. You know, good to see that it's come back again as well. So something else we did touch on was that whole concept of processing raw materials locally. I guess back in your day, you did mention there was a lot of steel processing and a lot of local processing. You would have seen the gradual decline of that. I mean, I don't think there's much that is processed locally these days, but you would have seen the decline of that gradually over the years.
Yeah, well, I mean, everything could be procured locally. There was no trouble at all. And I think it's very difficult now because a lot of those industries that were supplying are no longer there, and people have got to reestablish those to service manufacturing as well.
Yeah, and hats off to the people who are bringing it back locally as well, because I know that there's a government push for it, but obviously it's just not as simple as like buying some land and like, let's just manufacture steel again. There's extremely specialized knowledge that goes in there. You know, you've got the chemical side, the electrical side, the mechanical side. You know, there's a lot of different layers that come into it, but it'd be interesting to see where that goes. Something else we also mentioned was the logistics side. So you mentioned back in the early days that there was a lot more emphasis on rail, and you also mentioned that rail was more set up to support manufacturing. Do you want to just talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, well, but many years ago, the New South Wales Government Railways, as it was called, had sidings all around the Sydney suburban system and then all the way out into the country. And they used to run trains which backed onto those sidings and supplied material to different industries, picked finished goods up. And I mean, one good example was Asheville Station had a very big siding, and it used to pick up all the wire that was manufactured over at Chiswick. And there was a company called CW Wise used to transport it to Asheville Siding, and the train would come in, I don't know how many days a week, and they'd all be loaded onto special trucks and taken off to wherever it had to go. Whereas I think nowadays, rail transport's more interested in just point-to-point delivery, you know, coal mine to delivery at the docks or whatever. Mm. They're not interested in sort of picking up bits and pieces along the way. And they used to pick up a lot of produce on the way too. You know, pick up, I don't know, milk used to all come by train, and a lot of the vegetables and fruit were all on trains. And that provided a wonderful transport system. I know we used to send a lot of stuff over to Perth in those days on the Transcontinental because the road wasn't so good, and it had to go by a carrier, and that took quite a long time. So we used to send quite a bit of stuff by rail. A lot of it used to go by boat as well, which was interesting. Mm. And a lot of product for Townsville and Perth, and that would go on a Australian merchant ship, and they're probably owned by Australian companies in those days.
Wow, very different marketplace.
Yeah.
Just on that point with rail, like obviously it's, you know, we're a very big country, and our population probably still holds us back. But you know, the maintenance of the rails must be incredible. You know, the stupendous amount of tens of hundreds of thousands of kilometers that we've got of rail network in Australia, even though it has scaled down a lot. But the flip side of that is you look at a country like America, and their rail network is incredibly strong. You look at the massive shunting yards they've got in the Midwest. They're like 50, 100, you know, pieces of rail parallel with each other, and they've got automated systems, so all the shunting gets done, and it's absolutely incredible to see the amount of rail over there. And I dare say that whole thing of that concept that Donald Trump brought in, whether you like him or not, concept of Make America Great Again gave American manufacturing confidence to step out and be leaders again in the world market. And you know, I dare say they've got their infrastructure set up to support that better than Australia. I'm just gonna put that out there. Happy to discuss with anyone if they think otherwise, because I'd like to know as well. But that's what it seems like.
Yeah, no, that's I mean, you probably know, I mean, even in the suburban system years ago, they used to run parcel vans on the Sydney suburban system, and they were just dedicated to picking up goods at the station. You booked your parcel in at the station and put it on the parcel van and dropped it off at where it was delivered to, and the people just picked it up. So quite a bit of spare parts and small things could go by parcel van around the network. But I suppose the road's taken over now and it's probably more efficient and quicker anyway. But it's been quite a change.
Yes, indeed. Like as I say with all my guests, we could probably talk for days, but we're going to the point where we're sort of wanting to wrap it up, or in a few minutes anyway. But I'd love to just hear some of your insights, because as a junior accountant, I think you said. What did you say? Was it junior accountant?
I started off as the accountancy cadet, which was basically the office boy, but still.
Yeah, all the way to CFO. I mean, that's spanning almost 50 years, and just seeing the huge change in manufacturing up until the point that, you know, to the point that you retired, and obviously you've got your interest following, but. What would you say are some of the big, broad, sweeping changes you've seen in your years in the whole industry in 50-odd years?
The biggest changes? Yes,
Oh, sorry, I may have just dropped off for a second there. So I'll just ask the question again. Yeah. So with over that span of 50 odd years, what would you say are some of those big changes that you've seen across your career?
Well, I suppose the growth of Australian manufacturing industry was fantastic to see it grow and the way it developed and how much interest there was. The very clever people we had that were looking after all these things, very brilliant engineers that were developing things. And with the decline in the product, of course, these people tend to leave the industry, just as you were saying with the apprentices. They left the industry and that knowledge wasn't being passed on and it just became smaller and smaller. And that's why I think it's very rewarding to see these people that are setting up manufacturing facilities again, and you see pictures of what they've got, and I think they're there to be congratulated on what they're trying to achieve and do. But I suppose the big thing that's made a lot of changes, of course, is the introduction of computerized systems, and a lot of the paperwork now is totally automated, from order placing to delivery and accepting receipt of the goods and that sort of thing, compared to all the handwritten stuff. That's a tremendous difference. And but it's been sad to see all the I mean, we used to make televisions and fridges and everything. I mean, we just made it all. I mean, just around where we are here, I mean, there was a huge factory at Asheville, AWA, making all radios and things. And Birkenhead Point, that was the old Dunlop factory, and what we had at Fire Dock. And it just goes on and on. There was so much manufacturing, and it was all located in local communities, so that a lot of the people that worked there were people living in the surrounding district that provided employment. And I know at Campbelltown, the company's factory was the biggest employer in the Campbelltown area for many, many years. They were the first manufacturer, and went on for many years. And the company actually bought 256 acres of land at Campbelltown back in the late 40s, when the chairman, a chap by the name of Sir Malcolm Ritchie, used to travel up from Moss Vale to Sydney, and he went past and saw this land for sale and thought that's where the factory should expand from Five Dock in the future. And he had an idea that we're going to set up like an English manufacturing village and they'd have employee housing and that. So we bought the 256 acres at the factory. Never, the employee housing never came, and people just lived at Campbelltown. Then it was a growing community, but the factory was quite big and modern. And yeah, that was very interesting to see all that happen.
I mean, imagine going to the shops today and saying, I want to buy a TV that's manufactured in Australia. we laugh about it at the moment, but hey, you never know. But I love this whole concept of the community. Well, we probably see that more in rural manufacturing. Definitely, like your fruit and there's probably a lot of communities that do surround some of the manufacturing in Australia. I'd love to see that happen again. That I guess before we sign off, I just have all our guests just answer this question of do you think Australian manufacturing will ever return to the glory days of the 60s?
I think it will. I think everyone's starting to wake up now how important it is to become not totally self-sufficient, but somewhere down the line where we don't rely on people for even the basic things being imported, that we produce our TVs and all these things and all the other things that people so desperately need for day-to-day living. And it's important that they buy these now manufactured locally. I think that's very important. And I think it's great that people are sort of trying to look at this now and do things. But, even after the pandemic, I mean, looked like we're going to be short of a lot of product because it was coming from overseas. And,
yeah.
That was pretty serious.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, it's definitely opened up a lot of cracks, hasn't it? Yeah. Yes. So, I just wanted to say thank you very, very much, Dad, for jumping on and giving your insights. And I think your knowledge around, you know, you've got 50 odd years in manufacturing. There's a lot of knowledge there. I think it's fantastic. Back in the early days of the late 50s and 60s when manufacturing was strong, I think there's a lot we can learn from that as well that has possibly been forgotten or there's not a voice for it. And converting what we've got now into a louder voice to have some of the movements like, you know, the Australian Made movement to really support manufacturing, you know, government's starting to creep back into it as well, but have it as a more significant player in the Australian economy and Australian community as well. And, let's look at our capabilities as Australians. You know, we're known for high quality, we're known for innovation, and we're known for just getting out there and getting the job done. And what better way to reward it than through our manufacturing? So once again, thank you very, very much.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you for having me. And it's been great to talk to you, son, and I've really enjoyed it. And I do take it very seriously that we do grow our manufacturing, and I compliment the effort you're making and those who are trying to set up manufacturing operations in Australia from anew. I wish them all the luck.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you again for watching. We'll catch you in our next episode, which will be next month. And thank you again, Graham, Dad.
Pleasure. Yeah. Okay then.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks.